So I was very confused watching The Matrix Revolutions, primarily because the actor who plays one of the starship captains, I'll call it a starship, even though it's not a starship, is the same guy who plays the dad in Please Like Me, but he's in The Matrix Revolutions with an American accent. So I had a very sort of cognitive dissonance sort of experience.
Oh, the guy in the red ditto sweater for the who's having the argument with Jada Pinkett about that. Oh, yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
And if you don't know what Please Like Me is, perhaps one day you'll find out. Wink, wink. But they're like, what the fuck does that mean?
This is what we call foreshadow. No, we're hiding a spoiler for the podcast inside the thing. It's like foreshadowing.
Exactly. Like Neo foreshadows The Matrix with the Oracle.
Ooh.
I didn't love this movie.
I have to say, I have no idea what the plot of this movie was. Like, I legitimately had to read, like, the Wikipedia summary to figure it out at the end, which...
Maybe you can explain it to me.
We are not stupid people, you know, but it was just... But at the same time, I liked it better than Reloaded just because in terms of an action I felt Matrix Reloaded had too many long action sequences which just went nowhere, and liked them in this one much better.
That's interesting because I actually like the action sequences a lot less in the movie, and I think the primary reason is I like The Matrix. I think The Matrix is cool. I think it's visually interesting, and you know, aside from the very end fight with Neo and Agent Smith and the very beginning fight, there is no Matrix action at all. And
It makes
what I like about The Matrix less interesting because it's just not there.
And that's fair.
And the battle at Zion and the dock battle is very visually interesting, but at the same time, it's something I've seen in a lot of other movies.
I guess what I felt about the action sequences is even in the huge dock battle scene, I felt that they were able to make it a little more intimate. I mean, there are a lot more one-on-one fights in this movie. The fights are a lot smaller. Even the big dock battle scene is primarily focused on a couple of, you know, a couple of people, and
it's focused on the runner, or it's focused on the captain, or whoever that
is. It's focused on, you know, Harold Perrineau's wife and, you know, the other woman.
Yeah, her too.
So, you know, yes, you have these giant spectacle scenes of which I thought I frankly liked the swarming of the machines and all of that. I thought the visual designs of them were very effectively scary. You know, it was cool from that view, but I felt like it was, you know, it made it feel like five or six stories happening at once rather than just this aimless freeway chase, which is just these two bad guys getting up again. Or, you know, we're going to have a martial arts sequence with five people we don't see again and who are just computer avatars.
I suppose. I think, you know, the interesting thing with me and The Matrix, and now that we've seen all three of the movies, you know, it's interesting because I feel like I like The Matrix a lot more than I remembered liking it.
Yeah.
I think that The Matrix is a good movie. I don't think it's the best one. I actually liked Matrix Reloaded quite a bit.
Okay.
Yeah, the action sequences in that movie are a bit too long, but they're also very inventive. They're very original. They are visually interesting. And like I said last week, they hit the part of your brain in the same way that like a good musical sequence hits that part of your brain. They're just, you know, it's funny because we've had these discussions, I think, on the podcast before, but I really do, you know, primarily approach film as a visual medium first and foremost. And I don't think Richard does. And so for me, the action sequences, while they were a little too long, I did appreciate them on that level, just kind of sitting back and enjoying what was happening on the screen, what I could look at. In this movie, I didn't feel that way. I think that, you know, one of the reasons why the prior two movies worked, I think, better than this one is the juxtaposition between the clean and shiny Matrix world and the dirty future of Zion and the machines worked really well and allowed for a nice visual contrast between the two. Whereas this movie, I mean, I would say probably an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minutes of it take place in the real world.
Yeah.
And I just am not as invested in that as I am in the Matrix world, frankly.
Which is odd, but yeah.
But I think it ties into kind of the point of this movie as well, which is really talking about, you know, it's breaking down the idea that there is a difference between machine intelligence and human intelligence.
Yes. I will say, like, where the movie ended up was a different place than I think I would have thought seeing the first movie, but I did appreciate where it does end up, that it does end with the possibility of peace and reconciliation and understanding, and making it clear that it's not an easy peace. It was not an easy one piece. It will not be an easy piece to keep, but it is one that is possible to keep. Because, I mean, at the end, we all do agree with the Oracle that, you know, this peace must last as long as it can, and we must do what it takes to, and all of that. And, you know, so yeah, I like that place that it goes to.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, and the movie really does, I think, hit that groundwork very quickly when, you know, in the very beginning part of the movie where Neo is in that, you know, Mobile Avenue kind of holding down subway station between the Matrix and the real world or wherever he is. And he's talking to the machine intelligence, and he's kind of talking about the nature of emotion. And yeah, on the one hand, it is kind of facile and it is kind of a, you know, undergraduate, you know, philosophy course. But it also does, I think, tie into what this movie is primarily about, which is there is no difference really between the machine intelligence and the human intelligence. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you can say that the Matrix movies have any sort of coherent philosophy, I think it's that there is no difference between the two of them, really. And, you know, more than that, the machines are sort of not understanding the humans, and the humans are not understanding the machines.
Yeah.
And that's really where the primary conflict comes from, not from this really sort of, you know, I mean, frankly, you know, kind of hacky sci-fi dystopian thing that the Matrix seemed to set up.
Yeah, I mean, it was that conversation I found very interesting in the light of Next Generation and Data's story, in which, you know, in Next Generation, if you listen to our other podcast, Trek About.
Nice plug, Richard.
It said time and time again, Data does not have emotions. I do not have emotions. I need an emotion chip. And yet it's made very clear that Data has connections and friendships with other people. Data misses his friends when they're not there. I mean, Data very much loves the crew of the Enterprise, and, you know, and everybody. He loves his cat, you know. He has formed attachments. So, I mean, I don't remember the character's name. I don't remember anyone's character's names. But, you know, when he says, you know, Neo's like, oh, love's a human emotion. He says, no, it's just a word, you know.
Right.
What's important is the connection that's implied by the word. And, you know, all right, so maybe a machine can't love in the sense that, you know, you or I can love, but that is not to say that it does not feel a connection and a bond with other things. And
yes,
I, you know, one of the things, the movie makes it very clear that the humans and the machines are very different. They live very different. They view the world very different. They see the world very differently. And through most of the, you know, the entire conflict that's in the backstory of this is caused by, well, different is bad and they're not like, and I mean, it's a simple anti-racist sentiment, sure, but one that I don't think we can hear too much of, frankly. And, you know, it's we talked a lot about how, you know, in Zion and in the main cast, you know, it's very racially diverse, which, again, makes sense. You know, you have humanity has to band together those, you know, the...
They don't have the luxury of racism.
Exactly. And I guess at the very end of this movie, you know, and that's kind of where the movie ends here, because it turns out the machines and the humans don't have the luxury of racism anymore, because Agent Smith is is trying to destroy everything. You know, he's not going to let either survive. And so, you know, well, we need to team up to destroy this. And then once, frankly, humanity and the machines have teamed up to fight a common enemy, they've created some kind of bond between them.
You know, and I do, that makes me realize, you know, I do think that there is an undercurrent to the movie, which is indicating that Neo has become, you know, I don't want to say part human and part machine, but there is a real indication that his consciousness, his essence, what makes Neo has transcended his human body, and he is able to, you know, be in two places at once, in the Matrix and outside of the Matrix. He's able to control the machines outside of the Matrix. He's able to really, he is the counterpoint to Agent Smith, and he is the only one that can stop Agent Smith.
Just as, you know, with Bane is Agent Smith infecting this person and coming into the real world, so has a part of, I would say, Neo's consciousness. I mean, the version of him that's in the Matrix at the beginning is almost implied to be a separate consciousness based, you know, I almost thought of it as, you know, let's say you could download Neo's brain and, you know, create an avatar based on him, separate but the same as him. And so the version of him at the end is almost an integration of those. Yeah. You know, everyone talks about, oh, well, Neo has Matrix powers in the real world. And what I was picturing was that was going to be, you know, Neo doing wirefu and, you know, fighting around and flying, you know, the battle in the dock. Neo's going to fly around and fight the machines himself. And that's not the case. He actually doesn't really have anything that we see him using in the Matrix. He has this ability to really see the machines and destroy them if he needs to. Aren't really Matrix powers to me.
No, they're not. And I think that, you know, I don't think the movie has a good understanding of how Neo is actually doing that.
But it doesn't matter.
Well, it doesn't matter, but I think that it really ties into the idea that Neo has transcended his body.
Yeah.
Because I think that maybe what's happening there is a portion of Neo's consciousness that is still in the Matrix. And it's not that Neo has magical powers and can actually like use telekinesis to stop the machines, but that in some fashion he is able to keep a part of himself in the machine world. And that's how he's stopping the machines.
Yeah, let's say that
world.
The version of in the Matrix can hack into the computer of whatever squid thingy seeker is attacking him and make it explode. That, you know,
yeah.
He's working. He's controlling a Matrix version of it. Yeah. Again, I think the movie does stay allegorical through most of it in a way that I actually was worried it would not. One of the things I liked about the first Matrix was kind of a lot of the how it happens doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know, what matters is what it symbolizes, what it means. And, you know, I was saying at the beginning, I worry with, you know, giving more of the history of it and, you know, making that part clear. But they know, they do keep the mystique of it. This is a very mystical movie. This is not concerned with hard sci-fi at all.
Well, I don't think it's – I mean, yeah.
I liked that about it.
No, I do like it. And I mean, I don't think it's any coincidence that, you know, the last stand they make is in the temple. I don't think that – you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that they have a council of elders. You know, these are ideas that are imbued with something in our culture and sort of – you know, if you want to talk about collective unconscious, you want to talk about – you know, whatever you want to talk about, however you want to reference that, these are very profound ideas. I mean, it's a temple. It's not a church. It's not a synagogue. It's not a mosque. It's
very humanist. There is no conception of – I think the only time literally God is mentioned is at one point when they're attacking the tower. Someone goes, oh my God, or something like that.
Right.
That's the only time, you know, a deity is really mentioned in the series. But again, they do mention prayer. They do have a temple. They do have – you know, this is certainly a people that has a spirituality based on around the one is a lot of it. But as we're finding out, you know, belief is a process in these movies. And, you know, again, it is, you know, belief in the one is a roundabout way of believing in humanity or believing ultimately in this transcendence between these two species, let's call them.
Yeah. Well, I think you see that very clearly when Niobe lets Neo take her ship as well, because very explicitly, you know, Morpheus is shocked, but, you know, he's kind of like, I thought you didn't believe in the one. And she says, I don't believe in the one. I believe in him.
Yeah.
And to a certain point, I think, you know, that's kind of what this movie particularly is about, where it doesn't matter necessarily what you believe in as long as you believe in something that is good, transcendent, outside of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it does matter what you believe. I mean, I don't think that this movie is not arguing that it's okay to be a Nazi, but I think that it is something that it's pantheistic in a very real way.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, a fascism would be against the view of this movie because, you know, that's certainly this movie respects free will and respects, you know, a tolerance of the other's differences.
Well, and I mean, if you want to get a little bit political about it as well, I think that there
on
is
this
a very.
Podcast?
I mean, I think there you could make a very clear argument that Zion is socialist in the best use of that term.
Yeah,
I think that you could make the argument that the machines are probably fascistic. You know, and so I think that there is an interesting dichotomy there as well.
There is the thing with the guy in the train station. You know, his daughter Sati, and he says, you know, Sati is considered to be the, you know, he says she doesn't have a purpose. You know, this goes back to that conversation in Reloaded where, you know, oh, there's a program that does that pigeon. There's a program that, you know, does the way the trees are moving. You know, Sati doesn't have any purpose. She just is. She's delightful. And I mean, she's adorable in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, she's just a cute little muffin, you know, and you know, she doesn't have a place in the machine society because she doesn't have purpose. So and yet I think it's very interesting that at the end she's created this beautiful sunrise, you know.
Yeah.
So
well, I mean not to cut you off, but light in this movie is very real way that the movie is trying to communicate something.
Yes.
I mean, you've got that with the sunrise at the end. You have them going above the clouds in the ship, and they're seeing.
Yeah.
You know, well, Neo's not seeing the sun for the first time because he's blind, but Trinity is.
Yeah.
There's the way in which Neo actually sees the machines, which indicates that's how the machines see each other.
Yeah. Again, they there's the way that Agent Smith explodes into light at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is a very – light is a very significant part of this movie.
Well, it's very much about darkness vanquishing the light. I mean, you know, there's it's no coincidence, I don't think, that – you know, I mean, in my notes, I kind of wrote a joke down where I said, oh, look, Neo and Trinity are finally going to Mordor. But it is kind of like that in a way, and it's very dark. It's very oppressive. You know, there's
– And yet, you know, but yeah.
But Zion is the same way, though.
But, you know, and again, I love the part when, you know, you see this machine city and it's terrifying. And then again, you cut to the shot of Neo's view of it, and it is just pulses of light and energy and, frankly, life.
Yeah.
I mean, light is a very much a symbol of life. If, you know, you were joking to me that, you know, the only way they could have made Agent Smith more of an avatar of death was have him, you know, wear a skull mask and a cape or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, but, you know, he explodes into light. Light, that is life coming out of death, a very reincarnation, you know, metaphor. There are, you know, on the one hand, this is very 101 level stuff. But I think the movie does a very deft use of 101 level stuff. Like, it's – the movies are fairly confident in themselves, which is interesting, which I like.
I think that's right. I don't think that the movies are really breaking new philosophical ground, but they are very confident in their uses of the philosophy.
Yeah.
I think that the Wachowskis do understand – you know, what they're writing about in a very real way.
And they're not overreaching themselves.
No.
Like, it's
– There's
I was ready for these movies to be really pretentious.
Yeah, and they never are.
No. I think – because, I mean, they – I don't feel like they're condescending in any way to either the philosophical crowd or the action sequences crowd. They do put enough of a – like, the action sequences are very lovingly done. As I said last week, you know – both the philosophy and the action sequences are equal parts in this movie. And, yeah, I think it's a very – it's a movie that's been done with a lot of care.
Yeah. Well, I think – you know, it's funny you say that the action sequences and the dialogue or whatever you want to say is kind of equal parts of the movie, because I actually felt kind of a different way about that. I feel like – you know, when we talked about The Matrix Reloaded last week, I said that you know, yeah, you could take out some of the action sequences, but then you would just have a lot more ponderous discussions about philosophy, and that might not work. And I kind of feel like that's one of the reasons why Revolutions didn't hit for me nearly as much, is you do have more of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that the strength of these movies is not in sitting around and having ponderous discussions about philosophy, and when we reveal what we're doing next on Trek About Presents, we will definitely be talking about a movie that does that, and it's very good. But what I'm saying is, you know, the movie works better when it's very, very metaphorical or very allegorical. And so I wish that there had been more of that in this movie.
You know, I mean, I will say that, yeah, it's – the discussions and the actions are combat in two different ways. I mean, they are very literally – you know, two people are going to fight it out with ideas, and then they're going to fight it out with guns. I mean, that is a lot of the way that this movie is structured. And so, you know, it's showing this, you know, again, it's a very visual representation of what the ideas are kind of doing.
Yeah, I suppose so. And I, you know, I think that, I don't know, I wonder about the dock scenes in particular, because for me, I don't know that they have much purpose. I mean, they have a very important plot purpose.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is to indicate that without Neo, Zion is fucked again for the sixth time. There is no way that this...
Yeah.
You know, and I like the fact that the movie kind of elides the questions of how exactly the humans are able to build these machines, how they're able to have all of this ammunition, how they're... It's almost implied that that the machines are allowing them to have this stuff.
Yeah.
Because this is the release valve for what, you know, when we talked about Reloaded last week in that conversation with the architect, and he kind of explained the whole thing about how this is a cycle, and, you know, Zion is a way to get tension out of the system and allow for the machine artificial intelligences that perhaps don't really have a place to kind of get out of there a little bit and release their whatever's,
yeah,
you know, their sort of revolutionary instincts in a way. And it's just kind of the cycle keeps continuing because that's how the Matrix survives. But this time, of course, is going to be no different, except that Neo exists.
Yeah.
And so for me, watching those Zion scenes, there's a very real sense that this is a fait accompli. Like, you know, this is going to happen. You know, this is going to end badly for them.
Yeah.
And they all know it. I mean, when they all go to the temple and when they're all just kind of standing around waiting to die, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, and you get that great scene at the very end where the little, you know, Moppet guy who was, you know, aww, plucky and he saved the day by shooting down the dock gate. You know, he runs in and there's this moment where he's yelling, we won, the war is over. And no one is believing him because they're just in shock.
Yeah.
I think they were all preparing to die, essentially.
Well, yeah, even Morpheus says, you know, I didn't think this day would come, or, you know, I've been waiting for this. Yeah.
And you know that they're going to have an amazing rave as well.
Oh.
But, you know, and so for me, it's kind of like the entire movie feels a little bit like it kind of feels like an answer without a question, if you know what I mean. Mm. Like, I feel like a lot of this movie, while I enjoyed a lot of it, it feels a little anticlimactic just because so much of it is focused on things that we know are going to go badly.
I guess part of me, you know, yeah. It's weird because there's almost a degree to which I feel like the story could have been longer. I wish it had had a little more room to breathe. Frankly, I think it would have been interesting if this story had been told during the era, you know, 10 years later. It would have been a TV series. And I wonder if a more spacious version of the story would make a little more sense.
Well, yeah, because that is the one nice thing about television shows is that it does allow you to sort of poke around in the corners of a universe more than a movie does.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I do think it would be interesting to see where because the humans and the machines are in 10 or 15 or 20 or even 50
I mean, this
years.
Does feel like something where at the end the sequel, you know, there was a sequel trilogy implied. We don't know exactly what happened. The last we see of Neo is him being gathered up by this, you know, first of all, it looks like a, you know, gigantic insect mouth, and then we see the light version where it looks, you know, almost angelic and maternal.
Yeah.
And, you know, collecting Neo to itself. Is Neo dead? Is Neo alive? Is Neo in the Matrix? You know, even the Oracle doesn't really seem to know. So, you know, this piece is fragile. So, yeah, 10 years later, what's going to happen? You know, there are so many directions the story can go in 10 years, certainly.
But I kind of hope that Neo is dead. I kind of hope that, because I feel like if you really want to take the Jesus analogy, the one analogy, very literally, you know, Jesus has to die to redeem the sins of the world, and Neo has to die to allow the peace to flourish or whatever.
Yeah, but of course we can't forget that Jesus does come back, say some cryptic things, appear in some weird mystical fashion, and then ascend again. So, I mean, certainly there is...
And there could be a very easy way for that to happen in this universe. I mean,
there is an AI version of Neo in the Matrix, yes.
Right.
Neo becomes the new Oracle, you know, things like that, or...
We have to talk about the Oracle in this movie, because I don't like her very much. I
like the actress who does the... First of all, I like the original actress. She did pass away between movies, and...
Oh, is that why?
That's what... You know, they had originally talked... You know, that had sort of... The idea of
that's her, weird, though, because I thought they filmed these at the same time.
But probably, you know, maybe they filmed the... Maybe they filmed them, you know, one after the other more.
Huh, interesting.
You know, anyway, yeah, that's what happened. She did pass away before. And they had apparently discussed having different actresses for the Oracle throughout the series and, you know, didn't go with it. But when necessity needed it, they were able to kind of pull that out. It's vague. It doesn't really exact. That was part of what I didn't really understand.
Yeah, I don't think that part really makes any sense at all. And
but they, yeah.
I was a little bit frustrated by it. I was frustrated by it because, you know, I don't like the actress that plays the Oracle in this movie nearly as much. I think that the old Oracle in the first two movies had this, you know, sort of wry sense, and she was very sort of sarcastic in a way, but also loving.
Yeah.
And this actress, while she's a fine actress, I
she's trying to play the same character in the same way, and it may have may have been a more interesting thing if she had been a very different type of Oracle this time around.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it would be, you know, they're juggling enough at this point, you know, that kind of felt like, you know, we're just going to hope no one gets too upset about this because we don't really have any other options, you know. In an ideal world of this, you know, the original actress would have been all three films.
I suppose so. And I think that you're right. I don't think it matters all that much because I don't think the Oracle has much of a purpose in this movie. I mean, you know, she gets the sense
that she has a very important purpose, but I can't figure out what the hell it is.
I don't know. I mean, I guess, yeah, you could argue that. I mean, I feel like the Oracle in the previous two movies was very much about, you know, making Neo not believe he was the one and then sort of answering a lot of questions and things of that nature and kind of telling them how this is all going to work. Whereas in this movie, she doesn't know.
Well,
I think that's kind of what the movie is about. I think that, you know, if you go back to the idea of the cyclical nature of this and the sort of release and everybody knows what's going to happen because this has all happened before.
Yeah.
That, you know, the Oracle not knowing what's going to happen this time is a very clear way that this movie is telling us that this time is different and it may end differently. It doesn't necessarily have to end differently.
Yeah. See, I mean, one of the points of the Oracle and one of the themes of this movie is the concept of rebelling against a predestination in a lot of ways. I mean, a couple people mentioned in the Oracle, you know, talking to her, she just, you know, and she even says it to herself, like, I'll tell you what, but you're going to do your own decision either way.
Yeah.
You know, the architect will tell him you're predestined to go through this door, but he's going to go through the other door. The Oracle really only brings up ideas. You know, she doesn't tell anybody exactly what to do throughout any of this. She never comes straight out and says this is what's going to happen or explains something and says this is the way things are. She just kind of says enough that
– at the same time, she is pointing them towards people that do tell them.
Of course. She is certainly useful in that she causes people to think about things that they ordinarily would not have thought about. But – at the end of the day, she's really only giving them the tools to make decisions they would have had to make anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this movie is very clear about that. And, you know, this movie is very open and about that in the way that the previous two movies were approaching.
I suppose so. I think that maybe the role of the Oracle in this movie is less clear because it's making the role of the Oracle in the prior two movies a little more clear.
I think I know what you mean. Yeah. I mean, they're almost transcending the need for the Oracle. That is part of it too. In other words,
yeah.
You know, this is fine. This isn't humanity and the machines doing the same thing they've done five times before. You know, they've had a script five times, you know. The Oracle knows everything that's
very literally.
Yeah. The Oracle knows everything that's gonna happen because she's seen it happen so many times before. Now that things are finally different, she doesn't know what's going to happen. And, you know, I think, you know, the different characters' reaction to change is, I think, very significant. In other words, you have the Oracle, who is very much looking forward to change and knows it needs to happen. Ultimately, the machine, you know, head of the machines at the end decides change is necessary. But then, you know, the people in Zion, Morpheus. But then again, you have people like the architect or Smith, for example, or the Merovingian, who have a very, very distinct interest in things being, you know, or change in their own name. I don't know.
Well, the Merovingian has a very clear interest in maintaining the status quo because that's where his power comes from.
And his pleasures and his passion, yeah.
The architect, I don't know. I think the architect is a weird character because
I
don't know that much about him, and I don't know that we can really make any sort of clear statements about what his motivations are.
He reminds me a lot. See, the most significant line the architect had for me was when he's talking about, oh, well, if you, you know, we'll save everybody but 23 people or whatever, however many he picks.
At the end of The Matrix Reloaded.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and – or other words, you know, we'll – and Neo says, well, what if the Matrix is destroyed, you know, you're going to be destroyed too. And he says, there is a level of existence that we're willing to accept. In other words, you know, the machines have their equivalent of their 23 entities that they're going to repopulate their own species with and slowly rebuild the Matrix and all of that. I mean, the architect's role is, I get, you know, if you talk about purpose or karma or destiny, I mean, the movies use several different terms for the same concept.
Yeah.
Again, this is, you know, that's a human word. This is the concept that that means.
Well, to be clear, I think that, the 23 people thing was more about rebuilding Zion.
Yeah.
I think that what at the end of the movie, what they're talking about, the architect and Neo, the architect, when he says there are levels of existence we're willing to accept, he's really saying if all the people die, we'll still be okay.
Yeah.
In some fashion.
Yeah. No. And, you know, the machine society is not going to be able to continue the way it has with the Matrix being, you know, there. But,
well, it's really not about the Matrix necessarily. I think it's more about the people. But anyway.
But yeah, well, the people powering the Matrix. I guess that's how I mean.
Well, the Matrix is a side effect, though. I mean, the Matrix is not, you know, yeah, it's not the primary existence of these machines.
Yeah. No, like, I mean, so most of the machines are not at all interested probably in the Matrix, just as, you know, you and I are not really that interested in how power is getting to these microphones right now. You know, someone else is worried.
I'm very interested in it.
Well, then you should become an electrician.
Engineer. I think you're right. I think that,
an electrical engineer.
Yes. I think that what's happening here is the Matrix is a release valve for all of the humans that the machines are using to power their civilization.
Yes.
If the Matrix goes away, of course, if the people all die, then the Matrix goes away because they no longer have a need for the Matrix.
Yes.
Merovingian obviously doesn't want that to happen. The Oracle doesn't want that to happen. There are a lot of machine intelligences that don't want that to happen.
For various reasons.
The architect doesn't seem to care that much because for him, the Matrix is not the primary way that he exists.
It's a tool.
Because I wonder, I mean, I kind of go back and forth on this, but is the architect supposed to be the same machine intelligence at the very end of the movie?
Yeah. I mean, to a degree, the machine intelligence at the end of the movie is implied to be kind of a hive mind thing.
It's like the Wizard of Oz.
Well, you know, I
who is not a hive mind, but you know.
But yeah, like, so I would say at the end is,
well, there is something very Borgish about,
yeah, there, you know, the
machine intelligences.
Well, the machine intelligences and the Smith intelligences that we see are kind of two sides of the same coin. I mean, I would say the machine intelligence at the end is the totality of all of the machines in that city. You know, if we could, you know, let's say that each has its own purpose, its own worldview, and then that gigantic face is a literal, I mean, considering the design of it, it's a literal collection of these tiny, or, you know, swarms of machines. You know, I think that to me implies that it is, you know, he is speaking to every single machine at the same time.
Yeah.
I don't know where I'm going.
Well, I think what that makes me think is the reason why this eventually all changes is it ties back to the idea of love and emotion, and it ties back to the idea that, you know, the machines for such a long time were dependent on humans in a very real way, and now they're dependent on humans in a different way, and they don't necessarily have the capability of being okay with that.
Yeah.
Because once Neo changed things and Agent Smith changed things by becoming this virus of death or whatever you want to call it, and he's slowly taking over the Matrix, you know, the implication is that he's
taken over every person in the Matrix by the end.
Or
very many
of them. A lot of them. I don't think all of them. But because they do have that line at the end of the movie where they say, if people want to leave the Matrix, are you going to let them? And he goes, yeah. So I think indication that all of the people are still alive. I think that's
The other implication to me that I got was that, you know, Smith takes over, but when he's purged at the end, they kind of come back.
It could be.
Because
they do reset the Matrix at the end.
Yeah. Because, I mean, the Oracle has taken over. It's implied that Sati has taken over, you know.
True,
we see Seraph at the end as well. You know, so, yeah, I get the sense that, you know, by the fact that we see an infinite number of Smiths around, to me, that imply that, you know, he's taken over everything, and that's why everything is in such chaos.
Yeah, that could be. But I think that you know, what happens at the end of the movie is very telling, because the machines know that they can't stop Agent Smith. There's no way that they can. They need Neo. They actually need a human to stop him. And you know, Neo is not Neo is not all human at this point in the movie. Yeah. I think there's a real, very real indication that he is sort of bridging the gap between the two of them. And if you want to go back to the idea of love that started the beginning of the movie, I think that in a very real sense, I mean, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that at the end of the movie, the machines need to learn to respect and love humans, and the humans need to learn to love and respect the machines.
Yeah. Oh, you see, one of the things that reading plot summaries made clear to me is exactly what happens at the end, how they defeat Agent Smith, and the implication, you know, what they said was that so Neo is hooked directly up into the source right now. He is hooked directly up into the machines. He is, you know, part of them, and that's how he's jacked into the Matrix. And I mean, the whole visual design of that, you know, the cables coming to,
yeah,
you know, that was amazing. I mean, that was some really nice imagery, I will say. You know, it looked really cool. But when Agent Smith, when I liked that fight because it is a fight between two gods in a way.
Yeah.
And to a degree, this movie gets to the point of everyone's powers are escalating more and more and more and more, especially Neo's throughout this, as are Smith's. And at a point, it gets ridiculous because neither of them can really defeat the other. They are both immovable forces. And the only way that, you know, the way that Neo is able to defeat him is by standing down, allowing himself to get assimilated. And at that point, Smith is directly jacked into the source, which is able to use its antivirus software and purge him. That's apparently the implication of what happened in the
what I thought happened at the end was, you know, Neo realizes the only way to stop Agent Smith is to let himself be taken over by Agent Smith and then sort of, you know, rewrite his code, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of get the impression that Neo is being reborn in that moment.
Yeah. And, you know, either way, yeah, it's something similar to that. And either way, I think it is important that it is Neo and the source of the machines in a way working together to purge this evil.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. But then at the end of the day, you know, where does that leave everybody? Because
yeah, I mean, the question is, you know, when they say people are allowed to leave, so you're going to have people like Cypher in the first movie who is going to say, no, I totally love to stay in the Matrix, you know, and you're going to have
– isn't he dead?
I know, but I mean there's plenty of
people. Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry, people like him, you know. In other words, people who are living in the Matrix who would rather live in the illusion version of the world. And then there are people like Morbius who would rather live in the truth, and somehow they're going to be given a choice between the two.
Well, I do like the fact that I thought the movie ended a little strangely. You know, like it doesn't really come to any clear, you know, resolution about anything. But it kind of does at the same time. I think, you know, the entire point of this three movies, if you can say that they had a point, was to eventually come to some sort of detente between the humans and the machines. And that we do that. We know that that happens. And you know, so that scene at the very end with the architect and the oracle, where the oracle says, yes, if they want to leave, they can leave, you know, to me implies that the humans that have been released from the Matrix are now going to be able to go back and forth in the Matrix at will, essentially. The agents are going to stand down. They're not going to be around anymore. And so what's going to happen? Is there going to be a core of, you know, released Matrix people in Zion that are jacking into the Matrix now and are sort of like, you know, in a sense, they're like sort of
I mean,
giving everybody the red pill and then having to make the decision.
I mean, if I were making the sequel trilogy, there would have been, yes, people would jack in, create a religion, and there would be a religion based around people who have seen the truth and wish to go outside of the real world. And they are, you know, people from Zion who are giving red pills. And, you know, we could do a lot of communion. Oh, man, imagery. I mean, this is totally my headcanon fan fiction thing, but that's where.
But to me, it indicates that you know, because the thing about the red pill is that you don't know what's going to happen. They, you know, Morpheus does explain to Neo in the first movie that essentially this is not the real world. But, you know, what I mean, if someone comes up to you and says that, what the fuck are you going to think? I mean, you know. So,
yeah, but
it's like, I think that the way that the architect frames that is if they want to leave, they can.
Yeah.
Whereas the red pill makes you leave without you understanding exactly what's happening. And so the way that that's worded, and I will say this is a movie that is very careful with language in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah.
So I think that that's really indicative of the fact that however it's going to happen, all of the humans that are powering the machine world are going to be allowed to realize that the Matrix is a simulation somehow, and if they want to go live in Zion, they can.
And I mean, we, you know, I think it's probably it's implied by all the sun at the end that, you know, maybe they are going to. I can see the humans not. I can see the robots and the humans figuring out a way together to make less dependence on the Matrix, whether that's just by figuring out a way to simply clear away the clouds that are stopping the sun, you know, get the robots being solar powered again. And then, you know, yeah, they're all people who will want to stay in the Matrix and not deal with the work of rebuilding the world, which is going to be long and arduous, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and here we can go back into some Garden of Eden metaphors. There are people who wish to stay in Eden. Let's pretend, let's call the Matrix Eden at this point. And frankly, the scenes at the end are not filmed in that green Matrix filter anymore.
That's actually, yeah, that's a good point. That's true.
And so, you know, there's the implication that, all right, this isn't going to be the architect's utopia they created at the beginning and that people, you know, didn't really understand, but it's not also going to be Smith's version of the Matrix or the version of the Matrix we saw before. You know, maybe this is something that – I mean, there is a degree to which the utopia at the beginning was the architect's vision of utopia. How much does he really know about humanity in order to make an actual utopia that would work for people?
Right, because, you know, the architect is very dismissive about humans in general, and he says, well, you can't handle utopia. And it's like, well, maybe you didn't create a good one.
Yeah, I mean, it's not insignificant that at the end the two characters, you know, that it is this pure little girl who has just been loved and have been, you know, people have sacrificed out of love for her, and she's able to create this beautiful sunrise, you know. And the Oracle, who we know understands humanity a lot and, you know, is very compassionate and loves humanity as well. Under their, you know, the implication is that, you know, the reins of who's taking over who's handling the Matrix are being passed from the architect to the Oracle and Sati.
Yes. Yeah.
And frankly, I wouldn't mind living in the Oracle's Matrix. You know, there's probably cookies everywhere.
Agent Smith seems to think so.
And there's no fat or calories in that.
Maybe the last thing, I mean, I think we've exhausted the big topics, but I think that you know, maybe the last thing to talk about before we wrap this season of Trek About Presents up is, you know, the role of women in this movie is very, I find it very interesting.
Yeah.
And I find it very interesting all throughout the Matrix trilogy. But, you know, we haven't talked about Trinity a lot. That's for me, the whole love between Neo and Trinity and how that, you know, that's. That feels to me like the movie trying to slot that relationship into the overarching ideas of love and emotion,
yeah,
more than it actually being an organic part of it.
There, you know, there was Adam Kadre wrote an interesting article, but he was talking about how he didn't like the declaration of love at the end of the first Matrix didn't ring true for it. And he says both Neo and Trinity are kind of ciphers.
Yeah.
There's nothing in Neo to love, and there's nothing really in Trinity that's capable of love to a degree.
Right.
Now, to another degree, this movie, the series is about breaking that down, just as we say the machines aren't capable of love, but the guy in the train station and his wife love their daughter very much. The Oracle loves Sati and and Neo and humanity very much. And so, yes, you know, to a degree, it does. You know, yes, they need to have a love interest. It's fine to have them as boyfriend.
It's still a Hollywood movie.
That's all right, you know. And again, especially given as, you know, I don't feel like Trinity is, you know, damseled or made a chick in any way. And, you know, if you know what I mean.
No, I do. Yeah.
You know, she and Neo spend three movies rescuing each other until finally, you know, Trinity's time runs out, and then shortly after, Neo possibly dies. So, you know, I was okay in that regard.
Yeah, I think so. And
Carrie Ann Moss makes a great badass chick.
Sure. Yeah. She's great, especially in The Matrix.
Yeah.
I do have a little bit of a problem with how women are treated, especially in the battle for Zion, though, because they're not on the front lines. Like, they are put into a supporting role. You don't see any women wearing the big robot, machine gun suits.
That's true.
And
yeah,
especially in that kind of context where men, all things being equal, you know, are stronger than women just because of biology.
But once you put a power armor on someone,
exactly.
You have, what's her name in Aliens?
Yeah. Yeah. Sigourney Weaver?
No, the other one, the military lady.
Oh, I don't remember.
But you know the one I'm talking about.
Hammerhead.
Hammerhead Lady. But you know the one I mean, right?
Yeah, I do.
You know, there is a precedent. You know, this movie does not have a shortage of lady badasses in it. I mean, we've got the Jada Pinkett character. We've got Carrie. Yeah, there could be one or, you know, we see a few faceless guys go, yeah, we're going to, you know, we could see a lady or two in there. It's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, that's my primary problem with it. I mean, and also the fact of the matter is, I think that the two women in the movie do a good, the two women in the battle, at least.
Yes.
What's his name's wife and the other woman who we don't really ever find that much out about.
I think that's her.
Dies tragically.
I got the, I thought that was her entire scene was, you know, she's a friend of, you know, hers and they're volunteering together, but you know.
I don't know that I have that much to say about it. It just feels like a missed opportunity to me.
Especially given that they go out of their way to make the council pretty, you know, 50-50, that they go to make the population of Zion 50-50, you know, and all of that.
I mean, I do think it's very nice that again, you know, the bulk of the population of Zion is non-white, is very racially diverse. You know, that is a very key distinction, I think, between the way in which the Matrix world and the machine world and the Zion world, the quote-unquote real world human world, all kind of operate. So it's an interesting way to look at it. But yeah, I think that is a little bit of a missed opportunity there.
Yeah, again, especially given that, I mean, this is one of those movies that, it's the kind of thing where the women who are in very different roles. We have a medic, we have Trinity, we have, you know, what's his name's wife who, you know, decides that, you know, she's, you know.
And that's also primarily how she's identified in the movie, too, is his wife.
To be fair, I don't really know anybody's names. I don't even know his name.
Well, no, but she doesn't have a characterization other than the fact that she is sitting around worrying about her husband.
Yeah, I know. And that is fair. At the same time, she does, you know, at the same time, it is given. There are people who would sit, her sister, for example, the one who was Dozer's wife or whatever, or her brother, sister, or whatever. Anyway, she is, you know, she's carrying the children away at the end. She is more domestically focused.
Yeah.
But, you know, the movie doesn't say all women are domestic. You know, the movie doesn't only have domestically focused women or only badass women. You know,
But at the same time, though, I feel like her making the shells and her going out to make a decision to help, you know, defend Zion is, you know, it is textually rooted in her desire to protect her husband.
As she says, you know, which
is okay. But I wish, again, this would have been mitigated if there had just been a lot of women in the, you know, mechanized infantry or whatever.
Yeah. And frankly, the kind of thing that would have worked, again, imagine this is a TV series that she would have a couple episodes where she's doing other things, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe have that, you know, or maybe her journey is going from, you know, somebody who is just a wife to somebody who gets into the, you know, begins to make shells, you know, just to do something to help her husband and then eventually comes into her own as, you know, I don't know. But, you know, that again, this is when they give me a miniseries to write, these are the ideas I'm going to be using.
Well, maybe you can call the Wachowskis up and it's a lot of Netflix money floating around now. Hey. So, you know, maybe.
Hi, I'm Richard Goodness and I'd like to write the new Matrix, please.
All right. Well, I think we did a pretty good job with these movies. I liked them more than I thought I was going to.
And that was the thing. I had a lot of fun with them, and I was expecting these to be very dire. A bunch of people like, oh, the sequels are terrible.
They're not.
Yeah.
They're very different from the first movie. They're much less about a standard Hollywood action movie.
Yeah.
But they're also very interesting, and I think that, you know, if this is as highbrow as middlebrow culture gets, I'm okay with that.
That I think that's a good way of putting it. I don't like movies, and I had a great time with these.
There you go. All right. Well, we will reveal what we are doing for the next season of Trek About Presents in just a few minutes.
Okay.
But if you have any thoughts on the final episode that we talk about the Matrix Revolutions in, please leave a comment on the post for this episode of the podcast at trekaboutshow.com. Our social media username, where you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, is Trek About Show. You can go to patreon.com/trekaboutshow if you would like to provide us with a little funds, a little kick into our pockets for providing you all of these hours of podcast entertainment.
Yes, please give us a kick in the pants.
Richard really needs one. And finally, please leave us a positive iTunes review for Trek About Presents, not Trek About, although you can leave this one for Trek About, the flagship Mothership podcast as well. We actually got two new ones, which I'm going to read right now.
Oh, my God!
So Chopsifer says, great criticism and commentary on films. Eric and Richard have a lot of fresh perspectives. And even if they disagree, they are exceptionally skilled at bouncing ideas off of one another. I cannot recommend it enough.
Aww.
Thank you very much, Chopsifer. And we also have one from The Lev, who says, intelligent, fun discussion of various films with some sort of sci-fi bent, unafraid to take positions outside of the conventional wisdom or to look at things from surprisingly different perspectives. That they managed to find some new insights into something as ubiquitous and exhaustively examined as Star Wars is some achievement.
We achieved
something. I love it nearly as much as the Mothership podcast.
Oh, my God.
Well, you might not love it so much next month, but anyway. Which you also ought to subscribe to. So thank you very much, and The Lev. So be as cool as those two gents or ladies and leave us a positive iTunes review on Trek About Presents. It is one of the best ways for new listeners to find the show. And here's the announcement for season 3 of Trek About Presents, which is coming to you on April 6th.
All right, what are we doing?
My Dinner with Andre.
No, really, what are we doing?
My Dinner with Andre.
Really?
Yes.
We're watching My Dinner with Andre?
I mean, I'm going to.
Okay, I guess I have to too.
And then we'll follow up. what we're starting to do, if you may notice, since we did Groundhog Day and then we did the Matrix movies, is that we're sort of like doing a little aperitif, palate cleanser, right before we dive
into amuse-bouche.
Yes, an amuse-bouche, before we dive into sort of the meat of that season of Trek About Presents. So
the viands and vittles.
So for the month of April, we're going to be doing My Dinner with Andre. And then for the next 3 weeks, we're going to be doing the first three Kevin Smith movies, because you voted on Twitter and it was 88% to 12% for the Sunrise movies, the Sunset movies by Richard Linklater.
We were going to make fun of heterosexual people for 3 hours.
Don't worry. We can do it later.
Okay.
And we can still do it with, I mean, the Kevin Smith movies, because Frank, come on.
No. I would say that the Kevin Smith movies is critical of certain.
Save it for next.
Okay.
Month.
But that's just a little aperitif for the what we're going to be talking about.
We'll be talking about Clerks, Mallrats, and Chasing Amy. So that's My Dinner with Andre on April 6th, and then Clerks, Mallrats, and Chasing Amy throughout the rest of April. So look forward to that. And of course, as always, continue to listen to Trek About, the Mothership podcast.
We are deep in Deep Space Nine.
We'll see you next month.